before us, half buried in a low rock face. An antenna had been erected above it, and there were supply crates piled around us, many untouched. A low-power ground vehicle was parked a little way down the slope, and I could hear the putt-putt of a generator working. Telam motioned for me to wait, and he went inside. A few moments later, he emerged with a woman beside him. She looked old, very old, though given the poor physical condition of these people, it was hard to tell. She limped and was clad in grey robes that made her look like part of the dusty terrain around us. As she got closer, I saw that her eyes were milky with cataracts. In what followed, I had to converse with her through Telam. He acted as my novice in this, speaking aloud the signs I gave him. I will not convey here the full tedium of that exchange method and its many false steps, only the essential matter of what we discussed. "Who are you?" I asked.
"Soul Knight,"
she said, looking up at me as if she could peer through those misty clots in her vision and see me truly. The words meant nothing to me. I glanced at Telam, wondering if he had brought me to a haunt of the mad, but his expression was steady. He seemed to find her almost as fascinating as he found me. I reached for my picture slates. "Can you read these signs?" She screwed her failing eyes up and stared at them.
"No, no," she said. "No one can. Not now."
"But you know who wrote them?"
"We wrote them. So night, a long time ago, when we were mighty."
She grinned, exposing a foul, toothless mouth.
"The other king came, jealous of our riches. There was war. The old queens were turned to dust, and the old heir was boiled away. And then, after that, we still ruled, but we had to serve the king then, and use our riches to give him his empire. And that turned us poor, and ate everything up. And now all there is left is the dust and the wind. But still we see the ships, the ones from the great sunlit port, as they go to war, and we remember."
Her speech was halting, with a sing-song rhythm. I guessed that there was more to it than mere rambling, that this was the folk memory of events that had taken place too far ago to remain intact. Just as I was about to press her again, she lapsed into more babbling.
"We built it,"
she said, gesturing over the horizon in the direction we had come.
"He didn't. We did. And then it was the queens who lived there, and they gave him the looms. They made the patterns. All gone now. All the patterns lost. Stolen, taken by those who never understood them."
She looked around at the scattered equipment, chipped and worn in the ashen wind.
"We gave it to them, so we could live. And so we do still, knowing she will come back one day. Every 1,000 years, we look to the skies. One day, we will look up, and she will be there again."
She was talking about the citadel. That was clear. The queens who lived there might have been my predecessors in the sisterhood, but I guessed not. She was talking about some older set of occupants, the ones I had found evidence of in the High Chamber. "My kind," I signed. "The soulless ones. What happened to them?" She looked confused then, as if struggling to hold various ideas in her head at the same time, and failing.
"Yes, yes. There were the warriors, the ones with no souls. He brought them here, and we tended the tower for them. The stones were wiped clean, the looms broken and taken away. They were mightier than the old queens, though they made nothing, only destroyed. But they too were taken. They too were lost. That is the dark of Luna, the graveyard where the soil shifts. The wind comes and the words are lost, but the bones remain.
Who destroyed the warriors?
He did. The other king.
If she meant, through some confusion, the emperor himself, then that had to be wrong. Tell me more of this king.
He sent his hunters. We still sing of that night. Shall I sing you the song?
Please.
The other king was silent then. His voice was still. His eyes were blind. And lesser men now spoke his words with lesser hearts and lesser minds. They broke the tower. The queens were slain, and fire now burned the ancient rooms. And empty now the halls are still, and dead the hands that worked the looms.
I looked at Telem, as she half spoke, half sang. His lips moved with hers. The fellowship, then, were kin to this remnant. They shared the same oral history, even if its sources had been lost or distorted. Some of what she said made a kind of sense, but even the elements I could decipher felt muddled by history, a merging of several related stories. Who are the Soul Knight?
We are the Soul Knight.
What does that mean?
The weavers of fates, the makers of the greater flesh. That is why they came when the world was young. They coveted what we spun for them.
I felt as if I was nearing the end of what I was likely to discover. Everything the woman said was being recorded. Perhaps in conjunction with material at the Citadel, some of this could be unpicked. We are back now, I signed. The warriors. Does that make you glad? Things can be as they were. She shot me a final grin, laced with senility.
You should have stayed away,
she croaked, laughing.
You think the hunters sleep? They will come again now, just as they did before.
She hobbled closer to me, and I could smell cheap alcohol on her breath.
He has let them loose, the other king. While he stays blind, they are unfettered.
Telem was nodding sagely again. That made me angry. It had been a long journey, and all we had to show for it was riddles, shared among a derelict people who had only their secrets left to hoard. I threw some paltry coin into the dust, more than enough to pay for the woman's time. Then I turned away, gesturing for Telem to follow. Enough, here, I signed curtly. This was wasted effort. He scuttled after me. We took our places in the ground car again and set off across the wasteland. I knew, without looking, that the woman watched us go. I could almost feel her bleary eyes following us out into the night, boring into my back like a heat lamp. Telem said nothing and didn't look at me. I turned her words over in my mind, putting them in different orders, trying to make sense of what I had been told. By the time we neared the citadel again, I had lost the thread, and knew that I would have to begin afresh when the next sunless dawn came. Until then, all I had were the halting rhymes blurted by a crone on the edge of eternal night. I tried to get them out of my head, to concentrate on more useful things, but for some reason they would not leave me. And empty now the halls are still, I thought to myself, watching the dark pinnacle of our new home draw ever closer. And dead the hands that worked the looms.
Chapter 10. Jek. Now I had what I had been looking for, at least in outline. Mordecai and I returned to the Terran surface, and on the journey down, I began to piece together what needed to happen next. I'd spoken to Perith at some length on the command bridge of the Excelsis Crewer. She was astute enough to realize what I needed from her, and though she made no immediate promises, she also saw the opportunity for advancing her reputation. If the Navy could step into the breach and restore stability, her voice at the high table would carry all the more weight, and if that prompted Ashariel to respond in kind, so much the better. As for what we already had, Phalanx was an impressive sight, to be sure, but we all knew that its presence in orbit was more ceremonial than practical. We were not facing massed fleets of the enemy, but ragged battalions at ground level.
"It is badly mauled, in any case,"
Perith had told me, her voice low.
"Mars is doing what it can, but it will be the work of a generation to restore."
I had seen the external damage for myself and could well believe it. "What of its garrison?" I'd asked.
"A single company of Adeptus Astartes, under strength. No doubt they will make their intentions clear soon enough, though I believe Valoris has already spoken to their captain."
I was not at that stage much interested in the Space Marines. I would never have control over them and would just have to hope they acted helpfully. Conventional assets were a better bet, insignificant numbers, and under the direct command of the Administratum.
"Gunships," I had told her. "Flyers, fighters, whole regiments worth. Overwhelming force, more than the pinpoint strikes we muster at present. If we have to level whole subsectors, we should do it. These cults are being allowed to develop delusions of grandeur."
Perith looked at me, I think a little amused.
"Alexei kept you under wraps for too long. You have a fire in your eyes he never had."
Then she became serious again.
"We are of the same mind. It will not be easy, but matters can be put in train. We shall stay in touch, you and I. Call it the quiet road, if you will. I can divert a few carriers here and there, pull a destroyer or two from its duties. They'll enter orbit one by one, softly, and it'll all add up. You'll get the air power you need. Give it enough time, and we'll have numbers capable of facing down anything you could conceive of."
And we had left it at that. Now, travelling back into the labyrinth of the palace, I had a rare moment to reflect on how things stood. I had not, in truth, welcomed Perith's constant references to my old master. I doubt she had meant much by it, but it had not been the first time his name had been mentioned in my company. I had never, since taking office, attempted to mimic his way of operating. Do not misunderstand me. I remained fond of Tiron, for all his foibles and personal weaknesses. We had even been intimate, during that panicked time when the beacon was lost and demons were sighted from the walls of the Senatorum. I do not regret that. But nor do I see it as anything other than what it was, a human response to extraordinary events. We had needed one another for a short time, just while the beasts prowled at our doorstep, but after that, there was nothing, just a mutual acknowledgement that we had been there, and felt those things, and now it was over. He had been a cynical man in many ways. He had never felt the need to excuse his indulgences, nor slow his intake of fine food and wines, even while the rest of the planet suffered shortages. For all I knew, He was still collecting his priceless objects and tending his exotic plants, humming away to himself as the splinted ran amok in the burning Habs. Part of that had always been a cultivated image, one he used to gain the trust of more overtly serious ministers. If they saw him as a somewhat bumbling character, run to fat and lost to his hobbies, then the surprise was all the more delicious when they realized, too late, that their allies had deserted them, and their coin had run out, and Tyrion now had them just where he wanted them. I admired some of that behavior. The art of it, the way he made it his entire life, but I had no intention of emulating it. This was a new age, and one that required new politics. Tyrion told me once that he had always felt an outsider at the highest levels of power and had used his influence to exercise old fears of inadequacy. I was different. I had been born into power. The Jek clan had always commanded prestige, right back as far as anyone could remember, and so I had always been comfortable with it. At my scholar, exclusive, naturally, I had been the tormentor, rather than the tormented, knowing that my lineage made me untouchable. For a while, I suppose the greatest danger facing me was that of losing my inhibitions completely. Some others I had known in those days had fallen into that trap, wasting their talents and lapsing into a kind of lazy sadism. For those of us without external limitations, that is always the most obvious danger. Others I had known fended off that peril by retreating into religious observance. That was a common and respected means of curbing our worst excesses, and I had briefly considered it for myself, but it would never have worked for me. Do not be mistaken, I was as loyal a servant to the throne as ever existed, and I had prayed fervently like everybody else when the red lightning started falling from the sky. But a pious vocation could never have been mine. I was, and am, a creature of the temporal world, of its structures and its economics, its guns and its merchants. So I immersed myself within that world. I learned from those I might have once despised. I kept my ambition quiet and listened to the sermons of old men and old women. Every time I advanced a stage, clambering just a little closer to the pinnacles of true power, I would hear the same expressions of surprise. I didn't think you had it in you. But that was the point. I had always had it within me. It just needed to be hidden for a short time, kept wrapped up until I could make the moves I had always planned. Tyrion treated his career like a game on the outside, whereas it was deadly serious on the inside. I was the opposite. Diligent on the surface, but at my core, it never really mattered. I had become chancellor for my own reasons, to prove that I could tame my worst instincts. Perhaps one day I would decide I had had enough, and could slip into that easier and earlier way of living again. But not yet. Not while women like Perith could smile at me and express their condescending surprise. Not while men like Ashariel could look at me and see a functionary ripe for humiliation. So the work continued. The efforts to cajole and coax the council into convening a formal session continued. The coordination of food relief and emergency response continued. It never let up, not for a moment, and the long days began to blur into one another. One evening, after a particularly arduous session with delegations from various contingency bodies, I returned to my chambers. Mordecai, as ever, came with me. I removed my chain of office and enjoyed the feeling of its dead weight leaving my shoulders. "First steps taken," I said, with some satisfaction, referring to promising status reports from Perith.
"Only the first," he replied, supportive as ever. "What's next?"
I adjusted my augmetic data feed, retuning it to the harmonics of the secure grid within the Senatorum. Just as always, the first flood of data was huge, enough to make me close my eyes, step back, let it wash over me. Once you had adjusted, you could start to make sense of the network of information, straggling out in a tattered web from the palace and into the wilds of the urban expanse. One thing leapt out at me. A basilica, one of the largest constructed in the zones to the immediate east of the outer palace itself, completely destroyed. I went to my console and summoned up more picture images. The grainy sequences were distorted by distance and our perennial comms interference, but I could see the devastation well enough. Anti-flam teams were on site, dousing everything in chemical agents, and squads of Arbites crawled through the rubble of its demolished outbuildings.
"The splintered,"
Mordecai said, coldly. They had never been able to deploy such force before. I had not thought them capable of it. Looking at the ruins, seeing what would have been required to do that damage, I remained skeptical. Before I could reply, though, a priority signal flashed up on my retinal feed. It was always hard work gaining an audience with a High Lord. They, on the other hand, felt able to summon me whenever they felt like it.
"Chancellor," came a terse voice from the other end. "The Master of Administratum requests urgent audience. Your early reply would be appreciated. Transports have been sent."
Mordecai looked up at me, unease written on his old face.
"And what do you think can she be so upset about?"
I didn't know yet, not precisely. But my mood, which had been buoyant, soured instantly. Such was the way of things on Terra. A fleeting victory, then a fresh obstacle. "We'll find out," I said, reaching for my Aquila chain and wearily putting it on again. Violetta Roscavla, Master of the Administratum, the most powerful member of the most powerful institution in the Imperium, stared at me across her desk. The chamber we occupied was vast, befitting her status as among the most powerful in the entire Imperium. The walls were a cream-colored stone that reflected the light of a dozen suspensers. Thick drapes hung by gold-framed windows, the tinted panes of which overlooked atmosphere-sealed gardens crammed with ferns and orchids. Portraits of previous incumbents lined the walls, all of them staring out from the canvas with heavy-lidded expressions of gravity and forbearance. It smelled of incense, or perhaps the funneled air from the gardens. Everything there was priceless. Roscavla herself had a shock of ice-white hair and pale blue eyes. Her gown was ivory, and her skin was so pallid she might have been raised in an underhive. She was heavy-set, with red-rimmed eyes and a filigree of artful augmetics threaded down the right side of her neck.
"Space Marines," she said, spitting the word out like a curse.
"I do not..."
"Space Marines. On Terra."
She flipped a view screen towards me, displaying the devastation at the same basilica I had noticed just before leaving to meet her.
"These are the reports I am getting. And then, so I discover, you were there with Perith to greet Phalanx. And I begin to wonder whether these two things have any kind of connection."
"I knew nothing of this deployment,"
I said, truthfully enough.
"But you knew the Imperial Fists had been landed."
"I did not. I knew Phalanx had returned. The Adeptus Astartes do not fall under my jurisdiction." Roscavla was glaring at me now.
She looked ready to leap across her mahogany desktop and reach for my throat. And I had taken her for such a stolid, reliable soul.
"That is the point, Chancellor," she shot back. "Knowledge of your jurisdiction's limits seem to be weak at the moment. Just what do you take your role to be? To fulfill your duties as set out in the Lex, or to govern this world from your own golden throne?"
The blasphemy took me aback a little. I tried to get a sense of where all this anger was coming from. Roscavla was one of the regent's appointments. She was, as far as we knew, of the reform tendency, and could be relied upon to support the various changes the Primarch had made to the Imperial government. She also presided over the most important office within the Council, one in which the greatest functions were reserved. When Gilliman had asked me to keep an eye on the health of his legacy, I had not expected trouble from her.
I am perfectly aware of my function and its limits, I said calmly. Perhaps, High Lord, you might be clear where your objections to my conduct lie.
She set her chiseled chin hard.
I know what you've been doing. I know who you've been talking to and what has been arranged. You're not the only one to employ spies, Anna Mercer.
He crunched her hands together on the tabletop.
You think the mobs are a threat. You think we need more force to contain them. You've been trying to raise regiments. How, in any sense, is this your responsibility? You are here to serve the Council, not dictate policy.
I stiffened at that. I have been asking the Council to convene for months. My staff have practically begged you to form in conclave. If you will not give us a lead, what else can we do? And, with the greatest of possible respect, the cults are a critical threat. Something must be done.
She stared at me steadily, as if disbelieving of some great stupidity in what I had just said.
10,000 years ago, she said patiently, this place was besieged by the greatest army ever assembled by a mortal man. It failed. Mere months ago, creatures we were told only existed in the dreams of fevered heretics assailed the Lion's Gate in legions. They failed. And yet, despite that record, you tell me in all seriousness that this rabble, this splintered, pose such an evident threat to order that we must bypass all precedent and bring the angels of death back to terror.
Please, Chancellor, tell me you do not believe all this. Tell me that you merely maintain the illusion of ignorance for some other reason.
I guessed she had not been out into the contested hab zones herself, or maybe she had merely chosen not to read the reports.
If the cults were truly as weak as you suggest, I said, we would have put them down by now.
Roskavla rolled her eyes.
Throne, she swore. The cults persist not because they are strong, but because they have patrons. Do you really think the Arbites and the Inquisition, even in these degenerate days and with all the damage they have taken, would not have snuffed such a rabble out already, unless there were not some other agency at work? I was told you spoke to the Primarch before he left. Clearly, his acumen did not rub off on you.
She sighed wearily and rubbed bony hands up and down her face.
They retake sectors because they have allies. They resist destruction because they have mentors. Do not look to the void for the masters. Look inside our own halls.
This was ridiculous. I knew the ways of the High Lords. I knew that each and every one of them would happily slit their own mother's throat to gain a little advantage over their rivals. But risking the throne world itself, that was a fantasy.
Why would they?
I countered.
Because if you desire the reforms to fail, you take away security. You make it seem that the old dispensation, for all its fears and oppressions, at least kept the peace. You make it seem as if the new council cannot even look after its own realm. You make it seem that the haste to launch Indomitus was a great, costly mistake, and then, from the slums to the high spires, the whispers will start. It was better in the old times. It was better before Gilliman came.
You cannot believe.
Do not tell me what I can or cannot believe.
She clenched and unclenched her fists then, as if fighting off irritation, exhaustion, or both.
You have searched high and low for external help, for more guns, more ships. That will do nothing but add fuel to a fire your enemies wish to keep burning. The Adeptus Astartes should never have been called here. Their solution to any problem is to destroy everything they see, then move on. All the while, as the violence spreads, your real enemies are hiding in plain sight, yanking the threads you do not even seek to find.
These were dangerous thoughts. I paid no heed to the personal insults. The High Lord was clearly tired and angry, but it was harder to dismiss the matter of her accusations. I did not want to believe them. Perhaps that was the problem.
"You are mistaken about me," I said. "I neither summoned Phalanx, nor did I sanction any missions by its occupants. Do I welcome their presence here? Yes. Yes, I do. Whether or not the cults are being protected, it cannot last long now that they are hunting them. I make no apology for seeking to end this. One way or another, our walls will be secured."
Roskavler regarded me with heavy, disappointed eyes.
"You asked why the council does not meet," she said. "I will not let it. I do not know who is behind this, but I will not risk the passing of laws while there are adversaries within our number. To do otherwise would be treachery of another kind."
She leaned forward across the polished tabletop.
"See, it is easier to believe that our enemies are out there in the void. The true enemies, though, have always been here. We spend so long looking to the stars, fearing the coming of the fleets, that we miss what is right at our feet."
"If you have an accusation to make," I said, "give me names."
"I have none. Not yet. They are careful. But you and I both know who stands to gain from this council being weak. Those who never wished Gilliman back. Those who venerate the old Imperium and loathe the new. That list is long, but not infinite. If you wish to make the best use of your position, cease agitating for more warriors and uncover the cult's protectors."
I hesitated before asking the next question.
"So then, for the avoidance of doubt, do you mean..."
"Yes, yes," said Roskavler acidly. "There are those on the High Table itself who would rather see Terra burn to ashes than let a Primarch govern. They know their history. They know what his brothers did before. That is what we are up against. Can you bring yourself to believe it, Chancellor? And if you can, do you have the power to uncover it?"
I did not know. I would need persuading of the first accusation. It still struck me as outlandish, given all we had been through during the days of blindness. As for the second, that was even more uncertain. And yet, I was a servant. My duty had always been plain: to aid these people, working as best as I could within the guidance given to me by the regent. So I took another breath, already dreading what avenues this might send us all down.
"I shall look into it," I said.
Chapter 11. Valerian. We did not withdraw from the Basilica for some time. The Imperial Fists stalked off into the rubble, hunting for more signs of what had laid the place low. My brothers fanned out across the perimeter, similarly absorbed in seeking evidence of the splintered occupation. Though the destruction had been excessive, it was always possible that something remained that would tell us more about this new potential threat. If the throne willed it, we would discover comms units with codes to decipher, or lists of planned engagements, even names of commanders. The stench of death was already becoming oppressive. The heat of the waning evening meant that the bodies would begin to fester soon. In such concentrations, that alone was liable to kindle fresh outbreaks of plague, something that was almost as much of a hindrance to our efforts as the active work of the cults. I brought forward my existing plans to secure the area. Civilian response units answered my hails, promising as many anti-flam units as could be spared. Engineers would follow them to shore up what could be shored up and prevent further collapses. A demi-regiment of Astra Militarum was primed to occupy positions to our north to prevent the enemy moving back into place once we were gone, and the Arbites Sector Command had earmarked a precinct's worth of hurriedly trained enforcers to begin the process of establishing the rule of law again. Such work took many hours to complete. We laboured into the night, and by the time dawn came again, the many hundreds of bodies had been dragged into silos, ready for incineration. A few corpses were kept back, placed into secure biosacks, and lifted to the tower for further study. I witnessed again on those bodies the little desecrations the enemy performed, the flesh-cutting, the scarification, the image of the broken diamond branded onto scalps or sewn across shoulder blades. I would have wished to have had better material to work with. A bolt shell is a uniquely destructive instrument. It is designed to be used against well-armoured targets. When deployed against fighters such as these, with only improvised and poorly fitting protection, the effects are devastating. Most of the cadavers had lost integrity. We were dealing, in truth, with collections of body parts strewn across a battlefield of churned-up stone and torn through rockcrete. As the sun came up, I made my way east, picking a path through the still-hot wreckage of the old cloisters and out into a ground-level thoroughfare. The buildings to the north were mostly structurally intact, and I could see the glimmer of a few lumens linked to portable generators. Those on the south side had been badly affected by collateral damage from the basilica's destruction, to the extent that it seemed likely they would have to be pulled down. The loss of life had been severe there, too, I could see. The transit routes were littered with more bodies, most of which belonged to neither cultists nor Astra Militarum personnel. As I moved further away from the cloister walls, I saw a crowd of people, a few hundred, making their way towards me. They were singing something, a hymn, one from the Ministorum manuals, I think, though their voices were broken by dust and illness, and the sound they created was most unimpressive. They appeared to be led by a man in a torn cleric's uniform. He carried a shotgun in one hand and a crozier in the other, and seemed to be the one encouraging the others. As soon as he caught sight of me, he started to run, crying out with joy.
"Throne be praised!"
he exclaimed, falling to one knee before me, bowing as low as he could.
"He delivers the faithful from the darkness!"
Those with him were civilians, workers from the Habs, technicians and scribes and machine operatives. They were filthy, and the stench of their unwashed bodies was foul.
"We prayed, and you came!"
the man went on, gingerly reaching out to touch my boot.
"The angels of death, just as was promised! You slew the unfaithful and broke them on the spear of vengeance. We stood firm, waiting for you. Know this, we stood firm."
I looked beyond him, up towards the rockcrete cliff faces, with their hundreds of blank, glass-free windows. Thousands would have been accommodated there once. I wondered how many survivors had remained in those Habs, cowering as the fighting had raged. "Great numbers died here," I said.
"It matters not."
The man's eyes were wide with fervour.
"Better to die than linger in damnation. You are his hand of judgment. The souls of those slain now dwell with him in eternity."
Some of the others murmured approval. A few stared at me in some confusion, wondering if I was something different from those who had caused all the destruction. Most seemed to assume that I was responsible, and venerated me all the more for it. It didn't matter how extreme the violence had been. It didn't matter how many innocents had been caught up in it. They would absorb any degree of pain, just to see the anarchy ended. "Tell me what you saw here," I said. The cleric looked puzzled for a moment, then the words spilled out.
"As it has been, as it has been, I saw heretics, the damned, the wicked, gathering in strength day after day. So many turned, so many could not stay faithful. They were hungry, see? We have not had supplies nor water for months. But they were still hateful, the ones who gave in, and their souls are now in torment."
He grinned savagely.
"Then you came. I saw you. I saw you slaughter in his name. My master, the old priest, he rushed out when the firing began and was killed even as he went to aid them. Killed! It matters not."
The man crept closer to me, tentatively, as if he wished to press his face against the oromite of my knee guard.
I confess it. I confess that I had begun to doubt. Oh, not in him, you must believe me. Never that. But in those who carry out his will. Not all that has changed has been good. Not all of it. Not all prophets are real.
I might have pressed him for more, then, but he could not even tell the difference between my armor plate and that of the warriors who had destroyed the basilica. To him, we were all the same, a breed of unearthly angels dwelling in halls of gold he would never approach in life. If he survived these days, I knew he would tell of this moment over and again, recounting the hour when creatures of legend and devotion stepped into reality. I doubted he would remember what had been lost. The day was waxing by then, and pale light crept up the burned flanks of the towers. I felt I should say something to him, but could not find the words. It was not my role to inculcate faith, nor to tutor the weak. So I turned away and walked back the way I had come. As I went, I heard the hymns start up again, just as ragged and enthusiastic as before. Our intelligence was correct, Ravathane said. He had been analyzing signals from a whole range of engagements. The splintered were here, in numbers. By then, the transit canyons around us were filling with vehicles, troop carriers, mobile armor, all trundling up under the broken arches to take positions further north. My chamber and the two Imperial Fist squads had come together again to determine the next target. We gathered in what had once been an assembly hall of some sort, now bombed out, roofless, and lifeless. At the far end, Medicaid teams were setting up stations. Beyond them, in the yard, water tankers and supply lifters had begun to disperse their contents. Following their destruction, the faction will be depleted, Ravathane went on, showing us a few retrieved pieces of debris with the so-called convolute sigil, a tangled knot scraped onto them. The others will turn on it now to absorb its remaining fighters. We have the chance to engage before them.
If we're fast enough, said Garadon grimly. You have coordinates?
Ravathane angled his vexilla, projecting a ghostly three-dimensional schema over the rockcrete floor. A cross-section of the city sprawl spun slowly before us, threaded with highlighted routes through the Underhive's warrens. Signals from the locator range are marked in amber, he said. A number of sites under the Tri-Spire complex of Artaxerxia correspond to a likely nexus. I have indicated the optimal ingress. It was a subterranean passage, working deep down through the catacomb strata before emerging under the second of Artaxerxia's three great spire heaps. It was also close. We could strike at it swiftly. Captain, I said, wishing to honor Valoris's injunction, the decision is yours. Garadon's helm was on, so I could not tell if my care over precedence was welcome to him or irritating.
No more delays, he said. We move, now.
And so we did. We left our vehicles behind. Given the terrain and the need to descend quickly, we could go more swiftly on foot. Garadon's twin squads and the warriors of my chamber set off as one, heading rapidly northeast, out from the ruins of the Basilica complex and into the city beyond. We did not stay at ground level for long. Ravathane had plotted the most efficient route, which led us to a large vehicle elevator shaft system, the kind used to drop excavation machinery to the foundation sinks of the great hive spires. There were six shafts in all, none of which were powered or in active operation, all standing open to the sky, like wells into oblivion. It appeared that their control towers had been broken into, and signs of looting and vandalism were in evidence across the entire site. We saw very few signs of life in the habs around and above us. That did not mean the locale was deserted, only that the inhabitants remained out of sight, cocooned within the dank interiors of their lightless towers. If they saw us at all, I do not know what they would have made of the sight. Welcome signs of the restoration of order, as the cleric had done, or just another set of monsters come to punish whatever sins they believed they must have committed. We dropped over the edge of the nearest rectangular shaft, using its bulky machine encrustations as handholds and footholds. Rusted cage stairways lined the inner surfaces, but none of us trusted our weight to them, preferring to clamber down the chainrans and piston housings. The drop was significant. We were climbing for many minutes, hand over hand, moving as fast as we could, before we reached the required depth. By then, daylight was entirely lost, and we had slid into a world of complete shadow. My armour compensated, picking out the terrain ahead in a ghost projection of gauzy outlines. I assumed the Space Marines would be doing much the same thing, as their helm lumens remained dark. I jumped down from the last foothold, landing ankle-deep in oily water. Ahead of me ran a wide tunnel, big enough to accommodate an ore hopper. The walls glistened with dripping fluid, a steady pit, pit, pit. It smelled strongly of human waste. We ran, then, keeping our weapons unlit, speeding through the underworld in near silence. The tunnels ramped down, then branched again. We passed discarded maintenance crawlers, burned black and tilted off their axles. Rails had been sunk into the floor, though they were cracked and unused. Excavation equipment, turbo drills, rock gouges were all abandoned, stripped of any loose metals or electronics, left to moulder in the damp and the dark. "Signals acquired," Ravathane signed. "Astartes pattern," I replied, correcting him. We knew the Codex Astartes combat signals, which the Imperial Fist should have been able to follow, even if our usage wasn't perfect. "Signals acquired," he signed again, and Garrodon acknowledged. My armor system soon picked up the ranged scans relayed from Ravathane's Vexilla. We were now far underground and heading deeper. The walls around us were a mix of hacked-out rock and old brickwork retaining walls. I glimpsed signs of the splintered, painted on culvert arches and side branch lintels. They were a warning, no doubt, or perhaps an advertisement. Many converts must have flocked down here during the worst of the anarchy. Then I saw tripwires laced across the floors, and my augurs detected explosive charges concealed under supply crates. As a matter of courtesy, I signalled their presence to Garrodon's troops, but they were already adjusting their gait to avoid them, and none of us slowed down. The tunnels began to narrow. We moved out of the old caverns used by the excavators and into the catacombs proper, the worm-like crawls bored by the wretches who made a life down here, banished from the surface by poverty, guilt, or moral corruption. Soon we were closing on what appeared to be the first bulwark. Our sensors detected a power build-up, trace heat signatures, the solid mass of metal blast shutters. Beyond those were, as far as we could tell, larger hollowed-out spaces into which the bulk of the Convolute's followers must have withdrawn. I glanced at Garrodon. The time for stealth was almost over. I did not know if his kind observed any pre-battle rituals. For us, such things were largely eschewed, but I was aware that combat had sacred elements for them, marked by oaths and significance. "In his service," I voxed, "may he ward you." The response was unexpected. We tore around a final bend, swerving into a passage leading towards the sealed doors, and they simply erupted.
"For the glory of him on earth!"
they roared, filling the tunnel with a boom of machine-enhanced sound. The noise of it was startling. Their helm lumens blazed on, their bolters opened up, hammering down the tunnel's length and crashing into the barrier ahead. There were a few dozen guards in place there, sheltering behind lock-panel barricades, with their weapons already trained. Four automated gun turrets were set further back, flanking the doorway on either side. None of that made any difference. The warriors were blinded and deafened by the sudden explosion of light and fury, then knocked back by the barrage of perfectly aimed bolt strikes. The cannons reacted more slowly than the Space Marines, and were blasted into slivers before their machine spirits could activate their ammunition loops. The Imperial Fists charged right through the hail of debris, peppering the doorway with detonating rounds. In those few fractions of a second, it must have seemed to the defenders that their world had just ended, blown into spinning fragments by some sudden and complete rupture in reality. And yet, caught up in the midst of the assault, I could see clearly how precise it all was. The wave of sonic disorientation was an overt distraction, but the bolt shells all still hit their targets. Not one of them wasted. The doorway buckled, its metal plates blown inwards, and we crashed through it. The far side was a warren of its own, a mess of interlocking tunnels that mirrored the convolute sigil. Our bulk slowed us down in there. The defenders, who seemed to have been ready for us, started to get their first shots away, lasbolts and solid rounds that snapped and ricocheted from our armour. We split up, running the enemy troops down wherever we saw them. I plunged into a twisting tunnel that led off to my right. The confines were such that I was soon crouching as I ran, crunching straight through the reeling human defenders, trampling them underfoot as much by my momentum as by any skill at arms. I kept Gnosis unkindled, using the blade as a bayonet where necessary, and leaving its ammunition in the chamber. Unlike Garrodon's warriors, we custodians fought using the bare minimum of force in such circumstances, matching our effort to the caliber of those we faced. The combined assault must thus have been a strange thing for an enemy to face, a blend of exuberant violence and quieter blade work. We were the hammer and the rapier, dancing around one another in the shadows as the screams multiplied. The enemy here were more deeply corrupted than those we had faced previously. They bore early signs of physical mutation, mottled skins, bulging eyes, extended canines. One of them leapt up at me out of the gloom, her irises like a feline's, golden and slitted. I had to strike her twice to be sure she was dead, by which time others were crowding towards me. If they had not been such devoted servants of their foul gods, they would have been running. As it was, some combination of misguided faith and combat narcotics made them stand and fight. Soon the water lapping over our boots was black and thickening, our blades slick with cut flesh. The tunnels smelled appalling, a mix of very human stenches and other less definable odours. Flickering lights made the tunnel walls dance, and curls of multi-hued smoke snagged at the rocks. The passages extended before me as a false colour maze, constantly adjusting as Ravathane's vexilla calculated more of the cavern's internal structure. More defenders raced up out of the depths, and so at last I triggered Gnosis's disruptor field, throwing stark illumination out into the murk. I had little enough room to swing the spear, so I thrust it ahead two-handed, feeling the electric tip crunch through both bone and plate. The background noise rose in volume, swelling through the tight spaces, screams, shouts, the repeated crack of bolt shells exploding. I heard the thunder of the space marines as they crunched and bludgeoned their way closer to the heart of it all, the grind of their industrial armor, the whine of their servos, and the sharp clank of their boots against metal. The environment was getting hotter, far hotter, and the frenzy of those we faced grew ever more intense. One of them threw themselves up into my face. I could not tell if they were a man or a woman, but they carried a knife that burned with a blue-white flame, one that slashed close to my neck guard. I backhanded the creature into the near-side wall, cracking their spine, and as I did so, felt heat radiate from the broken body, an unnatural heat, a knot of otherworldly force. "Be wary," I voxed. "Gifted." I fought my way directly towards the central chamber, just as the others did from their divergent positions. By then we were closing on it from all directions, and we emerged into its shifting firelight more or less together. The chamber's many roofs soared away, upwards, exposing a labyrinth cut from the naked rock. Galleries had been constructed, gnawed into bedrock as if by insects, and figures writhed there, surrounded by translucent flames. I saw the primary sources of the flickering light, great braziers of convoluted iron, six of them, thrusting up from the dirt floor and thundering with coloured luminescence. The main chamber must have been more than 50 meters in diameter, and every scrap of ground was covered with a shifting, rocking, swaying mass of debased humanity. Most were typical examples of the corrupted, men and women still wearing the rags of their old uniforms and work fatigues, their disfigurements superficial, and their minds still more or less their own. Others had been drenched into a deeper corruption, and they stood out like dream visions amid the dross around them. They were taller, spindlier, as if gravity had less hold on them. Their faces were pulled into avian distortions, with wide eyes and pointed chins and pinion-spiked hair. Their hands were outsized, grasping at the end of emaciated limbs, and the fevered air cracked and spat as it oscillated around them. These were the depths we had sunk to. In another age, to discover a nest of such creatures on Terra would have been beyond imagination. Purges would have followed, information would have been suppressed. The Ordo Hereticus would have descended in force, their actions driven by disbelief and outrage, and the investigations might have lasted a decade. Now, we were having to confront the fact that this was only one of many citadels of debasement, part of a whole network that had sprung up in the aftermath of the gate's destruction. Knowledge of that lent fractionally greater urgency to our blade strikes, just a little more venom to our thrusts. We knew we had to cut this canker cleanly out, then burn the ground it had germinated in. We were facing enemies capable of posing a threat now, though. Warp energy spat and swam liberally, making my eyes and nostrils sting. The hot air wobbled as if set in gelatin, its fragility more than illusion. The slender figures waded towards us, each carrying staffs of their own, crested with feathers, rattling totems and hooked blades, their long limbs distorted by a kaleidoscope of lens flare. The Space Marines opted for ranged fire, using their bolters to break the crowd's unity. My brothers and I used that barrage as cover to launch a close assault. Garrodon's warriors were such masters of their craft that I had perfect confidence that we could do so without being struck. I felt a certain exhilaration again then, just as I had before. Bolt shells whistled on either side of me, striking down those dregs who might have hindered my passage. Everything was moving in perfect coordination, like some ancient brass chronometer whirring and sliding, and yet it was all unconscious, all extemporized. My blade by then was flying loosely about me, thrown with speed again now that the confines of the tunnels were behind. I thrust sharply upwards, cutting through the jaw of a cultist before hauling the starfield back to punch through the throat of another. My skin prickled as one of the slender magi strode into range, its own staff wheeling in a jerkier parody of my own movements. Our weapons clashed, releasing a mingled sheet flame of plasma and psychic force. Its corruption lent it both speed and strength, and for a moment the two of us sparred, trading blows while each seeking the killstrike. The creature thrust its feathered staff tip towards me, and reality sparked. The ground cracked underfoot, and a pressure wave drove me back against the blown rock plates. I allowed myself to bend with the force of the discharge, feeling the heel of my boot turn and catch. It went for me then, switching grip to turn its blade point first into my chest. I dropped away, pivoting around my center of gravity. The spear thrust missed its aim, and I powered back up, holding Gnosis securely as it slid smoothly through the Magus's bony chest. Its body cracked, as if it had been hollowed out already and was only held together by the flimsiest of sinew cantrips. Its bird-like scream was short-lived, a horrifying shriek that ended as I wrenched my blade free of its husk. Then I was moving again, kicking the residue aside to seek the next major target. I did not have to look far. Garrodon and his twin squads advanced steadily through the mass of cultists. Ravathane was fighting his way to my side, while Penjard and Cleus had found a way up into the high galleries and were slaying freely. The sounds echoed and overlapped, a lattice of screams that seemed to come from everywhere at once. Amid all that dross and soul filth, there could be no doubt who the master of this place was. As I laid eyes on him at last, I saw that he had chosen his name, the Convolute, well. In his previous life, he must have been a large man, perhaps running to fat from riches corruptly earned. The leaders of the Splintered were without exception senior officials of the Adeptus Terror, and this one must have lived well in that old station. He still wore his robes of office, though they had ripped now, clinging to his body like strands of seaweed on an old wreck. His limbs had extended and split, branching like the many tunnels of his underground kingdom, so that it seemed as if many tentacles wrapped around him in a whirl of flesh. His face was multi-hued, and the colours blotched and shifted as he moved. He was surrounded by a nimbus of flickering light flare, a corona of distortion that winked and flashed, making his outline fragmented and hard to pinpoint. His corruption had made him larger still, and so he towered over even my own kind, a great mass of swimming muscle, warp discharge, and sense dislocation. I fought my way directly for him, driving a path through dozens of lesser warriors. He saw me coming, and opened up with a huge crude rotary cannon he had tucked under one tentacular arm. Its shells flew at me thickly, and I ducked and jinked to avoid them, sweeping through the poorly aimed torrent to bring my blade to bear. He was moving fast, too fast for all that corrupted muscle, and somehow matched the speed of my attack. He cast the cannon aside and pulled a multitude of hooks and gouges out,